This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, March 11th. I'm Dave Benninger. Glad to have you joining us. Coming up this week, the House passed an operating budget in the wee hours of the morn. We'll get reaction.
I don't think anybody's really happy about this budget. I really don't. But then again, you know, it's not unexpected because we've never had to face deficits like this.
Mushers along the Iditarod Trail will soon be passing through one community in KDLG's listening area. Do you know which one? We'll tell you in a bit and check in there to see what's happening. The Western Alaska Interdisciplinary Science Conference is underway with dozens of interesting presentations on a range of fields and topics. To sum up some of the highlights, KDLG asked the presenters to tell us in a sentence or less what they're here to talk about.
I'm basically the help desk for all 229 tribes in Alaska with solid and hazardous waste. So I'm the garbage guru for the state of Alaska.
And we'll make more room than usual in this 30-minute show to talk with an old friend of KDLG who was in town as the WASC keynote speaker.
It's difficult and challenging to, you know, get reporters to be able to go out, cover, broadcast, get it out. Nothing does that better than radio. And it's just critically important.
Our Friday conversation with former KDLG news director Bob King. Coming up with the rest of those stories after a brief look back at some of the week's news. After several days of intense debate, members of Alaska's House of Representatives passed the state's operating budget on the House floor this morning. The bill passed by a 24-14 vote at a little past 3 a.m. The vote was mainly along caucus lines, save for Representative Laura Reinbold, a Republican ousted from the majority last year after she voted against the budget, a vote she repeated this morning. The Republican majority says their version will cut day-to-day spending in Alaska by 10%. That now goes to the Senate. Dillingham police have not identified any suspects in last weekend's shooting at an officer by the landfill on Waskey Road. Officer Tanner Lowry says an individual in a truck he was attempting to pull over early Sunday morning after a chase jumped out and fired two shots at his vehicle from a small caliber handgun. Both shots struck the hood of the police cruiser, and Officer Lowry was not harmed. Two of the individuals fled on foot and the truck drove away. Sergeant Rodney Etheridge says a shooting at police or a police vehicle hasn't happened in Dillingham in a long time, though officers certainly stay ready.
We're all very vigilant and try to stay ready for that to happen, but you just don't expect that our people in our community are going to try to do that to us, and it angers me that this happened, and we're going to find out who this was.
In King Salmon this week, several law enforcement agencies cooperated to intercept heroin and meth being carried in on a flight from Anchorage Tuesday evening. While authorities have not said exactly how much was seized, they did call it a very valuable amount that was intended for sale. 24-year-old Alex Savo of Naknek and 20-year-old Taylor Lack from Wasilla were arrested and charged with several felonies each. State Trooper Alfred Borrego says the public has been giving authorities more useful tips to try and help stop the drug trafficking.
These people have finally had their stomach full of it. We've had deaths as a result, both homicide, as you know, and deaths by overdose. The families are torn up. We have people coming into our offices crying with tears in their eyes because their loved ones are dead. And frankly, you know, if we can step on this, we're going to do it. And this is just a small part of that.
Savo and Lack are being held on $5,000 bail each. The State House passed a bill Monday that provides civil immunity to those who give an antidote to reverse overdoses from heroin and other drugs. Senate Bill 23, sponsored by Democrat Johnny Ellis, received unanimous support in the House and is expected to go soon to the governor's desk for his signature. The replacement for the late Max Gruenberg was named and approved this week. Ivy Sponholz joined the Democratic minority and said her first priority is to help avoid the economic problems the state experienced back in the 1980s during another major budget shortfall. In an interview with APRN, Sponholz says that as a teenager with divorced parents, she remembers those times and they were tough.
I don't want to ever go through that again, and I wanted to be a part of the conversation in hopes that we can start thinking about the Alaska that we want to have and, you know, not just the Alaska that, you know, is convenient for us to pay for.
Sponholz says she plans to run to be elected to the seat this coming fall. BP announced it will cut the number of drill rigs operating at Prudhoe Bay from 5 to 2 on account of the continued low price of oil. That may affect some 200 jobs. 2,000 miles away, two Dillingham youths wrapped up competition at this year's Arctic Winter Games in Nook, Greenland. 7th grader Christian Gardner and junior Tanner Savo are on their way back home this weekend. Savo, with 3 gold medals for wrestling events in his hand, his dad Jack Savo says he couldn't be prouder.
if I could use the word surreal, I kind of keep waiting to wake up every day and go, you know, my son's not halfway around the world competing in something as unique as this. It's amazing. And to see kids like Tanner and Christian, you know, work very, very hard at their particular events, and to see some success. You know, we don't always see success in life no matter how hard we work, but, you know, it's more opportunities, especially for your own children, that when they work really, really hard and you see that work every day, and to see some level of success. It's pretty unreal for me as a father.
In other sports news, as of midday, Ali Zirkel became the first to reach the Galena checkpoint on the Iditarod Trail, pulling in before noon. She overtook Brent Sass just outside of Ruby, who was not far behind. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. Early this morning, the Alaska House passed its version of an operating budget for the state. The floor session started around 10:30 yesterday morning and continued till nearly 4 a.m. today. The vote was 24-14 to pass the spending package. $3.8 billion in agency spending, just over $4 billion in unrestricted general fund spending for total operations. The Republican Majority Caucus is touting a 10% reduction of day-to-day government spending over the current year. Democrats in the minority caucus lamented their failed efforts to get spending for programs they argued were too important to cut. The House budget has now been transferred to the Senate, which will take its turn probably next week before the two bodies compromise their efforts. House members shuffled home around 5 a.m. this morning. Representative Bryce Edgman offered a reaction just a little bit ago by phone from Juneau. I asked first about the passions that emerged over the past week, coming to a head over the many hours late last night.
You know, I've been through this ritual so many years. So, of course, last night in the House, that was expected to hear the sky was falling or this was dramatically wrong and your values are different than mine and all the sort of rhetorical statements. But it did go long and, you know, a little longer than I expected.
What got back into the budget that was important to you, or what cuts did you see that were made that were important or that you disagreed with?
Well, I was very focused on getting the Dillingham DA back in that office funding back into the budget, and I got that accomplished. I took a lot of work, and certainly I didn't do it by myself. There was a lot of help from the region and down here, but I was also very keen on getting back public broadcasting funding, and I worked with Representative Kathy Munoz from Juneau, and we got the governor's number at least restored. Again, the Senate budget is going to have different features in it. Later in the session, we're going to sort of turn a whole different corner and go into a discussion about new revenues. At that point, when we start talking about tapping actually into the savings account, there will be a three-quarters vote that the House Democrats will, get another bite at the apple, if you will, in some sense about their priorities being in the budget. And I guess one thing I should mention, and it's far from being over, but it's that K through 12 in the House budget, we left the governor's proposal intact, and that's with the $50 BSA funding. So I'm pleased about that, even though that's just sort of another step in the journey of getting through session and a lot of bigger moving parts this year, more than the ordinary.
What's your sense of who's happy this morning? We heard from some on the right side of the aisle that they wanted to cut more. We heard from some on the left side that said we're cutting way too much here. Who wakes up this morning after a little rest and says, you know what? What we came out with was pretty good.
I don't think anybody's really happy about this budget. I really don't. But then again, you know, it's not unexpected because we've never had to face deficits like this. And I guess I would once again emphasize to people who haven't yet started talking about new revenues, that is going to be even more painful. I can guarantee that.
Much more to follow along. Bryce, I would ask you, our next guest on this program today is Bob King. Any thoughts about Bob King's tenure here in Bristol Bay, especially here at KDLG, that comes to your mind?
Well, to me, Bob King is an icon in Bristol Bay. You know, I first met him when I was 15 years old. I still remember the day. Of course, he spent, I think it was 17 years out in KDLG. Bob King is a great guy. He's got a world of experience, and you know, what a treat for you to have him there at the station.
Representative Bryce Edgman joining us for reaction on the House passing its version of the operating budget very early this morning. Bryce, thank you for the time as always, and we'll speak with you again soon, probably next week.
I look forward to it, Dave.
Okay, we cheated a bit for the segue to our next interview. Bob King showed up in Dillingham in 1978 to do some AM radio news at a little three-year-old station called KDLG. He was quickly hooked by the place, the people, the history, and especially the fishery, all of which he reported on, often as a one-man show, for the next 17 years. King earned himself the title, the voice of Bristol Bay, a jersey one might say was appropriately retired when he left in 1994. From there, he got into politics, serving as a press secretary for Governor Tony Knowles, then more recently as a legislative aide for Senator Mark Begich through 2015. Early 2015, along the way, King has been recording and writing about and now helping to preserve the history of Bristol Bay. He was in town this week to deliver a keynote address about some of that. I invited him here into our studios to talk about that and more. Bob, it's awfully nice to have you back here on public radio in Bristol Bay.
It's a pleasure to be back.
What have you been up to for several years? You were with Senator Begich. You were his advisor on fish issues, right?
And related issues, but fisheries was one of the big ones for sure. But I was also his legislative assistant for the Coast Guard on oceans issues in general, and also on Arctic stuff. So it's a pretty big plate. But you know, fish was just so important. It took up a lot of my time.
What did you learn while you were there?
One, how important the fisheries remain in Alaska. It really underscored that having people, have fishermen come in, have processors come in, and also understanding too the complexities about, you know, changes in legislation and the like, how difficult it was, how contentious it was. If you try to change something, say in Alaska or whatever, it could have effects that might affect the Gulf of Mexico or New England. Likewise, they have proposals that came up to change the Magnuson Act, trying to affect their fisheries and the like, which all of a sudden had unintended consequences up in the North Pacific. So you heard a lot about those, and it's why Alaska is such a productive region.
When is Magnuson up for reauthorization, and what major issues do you see are at stake that we might keep our eye on?
Technically, it is up for reauthorization right now, but that doesn't mean it goes away, and it doesn't mean it's not funded, but it is due to have a reevaluation. And look at some changes. You know, from Alaska's perspective, we don't really want any changes. Things are going quite well. We have strong steps to conserve the runs, to limit the harvest, to adjust things on our own. It's other fisheries, whether they're in the Gulf of Mexico or in New England area, that are having serious problems, and they're proposing changes. A lot of them may have consequences up here in Alaska. So it's important to watch very carefully what's being proposed and try to anticipate any side. But from Alaska's perspective, just continue what's already been a success.
Mm. You got into politics a bit there for a while, out now with Senator Begich being defeated there by Senator Sullivan. For the moment anyway, you're out. Did you enjoy the shift to that world?
You know, enjoy is somewhat of a loaded word. It was a fascinating job. It was fascinating to have that perspective, to meet with and work with a lot of good people, whether they're people with NOAA, I gain a lot of respect for, who really are top-notch, to work with other people in the administration, other congressional staffers who I worked with in the Senate. There's some very good, smart, and sharp people, and they focus in on a lot of, you know, a lot of tough issues, and that was fascinating for me. Totally frustrating, though, to see the increased partisanship that you see back in Congress, the lack of progress on issues, the inability to the funding restrictions that are on right now, are because there are a lot of good programs and things that need to be done, but the the budget sequestration efforts and other ways to try to pare back, you know, federal spending, they impacted, you know, the ability for the North Pacific Council and others to do a lot of the research. Same thing for the Halibut Commission and others, to be able to do the needed research that needs to be done to resolve a number of issues affecting the conservation of our seafood. So that was very frustrating.
Mm. Over the years, you've penned a number of articles, books, taken photographs, essays, and the rest. You've become not an amateur historian because you get paid for it, but it's such a noble role that that mantle isn't picked up by very many people. And you're called on now to present a lot of these things, and they just fascinate people when you do these stories that are otherwise forgotten.
You know, and that actually comes out of, you know, my time here at KDLG because. When I moved to Dillingham in 1978, the fishery was actually just coming back after being in a terrible state, and there was a lot of interest. There were a lot of changes that were being made that had brought broad impacts and the like. And I was amazed to find that despite the importance of the salmon industry in particular in Bristol Bay and other fishing that goes on for the state of Alaska, that the documentation of its past is pretty bad. There are not a lot of books and not a lot of stories just about the history, the way canneries came in, the way regulations were made to conserve the runs, how we got to a role where our salmon runs and our other fisheries are sustainable. An admirable position, and that's actually what I'm back in Dillingham to talk about. I'll be able to give a presentation at the Western Alaska Science Interdisciplinary Science Conference, and talk just about all the steps that took place to make sure that our runs are indeed sustainable. But I'm also working with a number of other historians who are keyed in on this issue, and looking at ways to preserve some of the canneries. You know, over the years there are over 50 canneries built in Bristol Bay, and there may be a dozen or so left. And if you go down and look at many of them,
they're fading into the tundra.
They're getting lost. They get burned down.
We probably have a number of houses in town built from some of those canneries.
Exactly,
which is one way of preserving, I suppose. But
that is, and we're lucky that, you know, here in Dillingham, the Peter Pan cannery is still operational. Peterson Point, the Diamond E at Igigik, and others. There still are some great canneries that are around, and we're looking at ways to preserve it. The one cannery we're particularly concerned about is the Diamond N in South Naknek. That cannery was built first in 1890. It canned fish until like 2003, so for over 100 years, it was one of the most productive canneries in Alaska. And you think about all the millions of fish that were canned there. Think about the thousands of people that it brought up to the region from the Italian and Norwegian guys who came in the early days, the Filipino cannery workers. It really affected, you know, the community and the cultural life of South Naknek. The same thing is happening here in Dillingham, Togiak, and elsewhere. And we'd love to find a way to try to preserve a facility like that.
Working on your own in this gathering of good historical data, you beat fishing game to an important number of Bristol Bay milestone that this summer you predict the 2 billionth commercially caught salmon will be landed somewhere in the bay. It may be a coho, a chinook, a red. Now, you rankled their feathers a bit. They kind of want that notoriety, but tell me about the 2 billionth salmon.
Yeah, it's funny. I've been over the years, I've been keeping a record, rolling total of how many fish have been caught. And it's varied so much over the years, you know. Mm. I mean, in the early part of the 20th century, the average was about 15 million salmon. And the runs were terrible in the middle part of the century after World War II to the 1970s. You know, the average was about 8 million salmon per year. But since then, runs have come back, and they've come back strong. And the average now is like 26. And when I saw that, I just started adding up the numbers. I had got a spreadsheet and just kept sort of a running total. And I knew we were getting close. But when I saw that, when the Fish and Game's forecast came out, I saw that, and they predicted a catch next year of $30 million. That would put it over the top. And at the time, and when we talked, several months ago about this, I predicted actually we were, I think, about 10 million fish away.
Mm-hmm.
After I did that story, Tim Sands called me up and says, "Okay, where do you get these numbers?" And I said, "Well, let me, and they're different sources. There's this Ken Middleton report who documented, all these things, and there are some previous reports where those are based on." And I said, let me sort of update this, and I'll get back to you. And I'm actually going to at this conference, I'll give my update. And I think we're only about 8 million away.
Oh, okay.
All right. And I'll make my argument about that at this conference, and we'll see. In some respects, this is really pointless because it's just a historic number. It won't affect the science and our understanding of management. It's not going to change how the forecast is made for next year at all, but I think historians and others always look for a little bit of accuracy. And I think it's really a feather in and I would say actually in Fish and Game's cap, as well as the fishermen and processors who now have a real commitment to sustainability and conservation measures, that we are reaching this fish. I said earlier that I think every fisherman can and should be able to claim that they caught that fish
right.
next year.
Right.
Doesn't matter, because it's a shared commitment and responsibility that's made Bristol Bay so productive. And that's really a moment to congratulate. And Fish and Game has to be included, because it was their efforts that they took, especially since statehood, that they made the tough decisions over the years. But it's really led to the productivity as well as the sustainability of Bristol Bay.
Mm. Public broadcasting, you spent close to two decades here in this kind of a role. Do you think there's a future for it? Things have certainly changed since you first started till now. Technology has made some parts of what we do a little less, or we have more competition, I would say. What's the future for public broadcasting in Alaska?
I think it's absolutely critical. And I've just, having worked in public broadcasting, not just the 17 years in Dillingham, but working at public radio stations beforehand, and I still volunteer every now and then. I've done a few board shifts some here to there down in Juneau when I have some free time. I think it's absolutely important, not just for the entertainment and the programming that you see, but I think the news function is critically important. It's difficult and challenging to get reporters to be able to go out, cover, broadcast, get it out. Nothing does that better than radio. Radio has always had the unique ability to be able to just get in a person's head through the ears. So it's you can take in the news, or you can listen to entertainment, to the music and the like. When you're driving a car, when you're working, you can be in the background. And it's just critically important. But I think public broadcasting, locally based public broadcasting, to be able to cover the stories, whether it's in Dillingham, whether it's Bethel, Kotzebue, whatever, that voice needs to be there. And giving it access to the community, and being able to talk about the issues the community cares about, is, I think, just really important.
17 years you became the voice of Bristol Bay. What do you miss about it?
It was
certainly there were good and bad times, I would guess.
Oh, there were, and there were a lot of tough issues.
Yeah.
Over those years. But I think I miss the close interaction, connection with the local community. It was fun. It was just a real privilege, actually, going out, just walking down the street, talking to people about the things that impact them, going down to the docks and talking to fishermen. But just that interconnection of the community, and it's fun. Just in the last day since I've been walking around town, I just run into friends and talk about issues, and it's just important. I've always been amazed that people still recognize my voice, because it's been a while since I've been here, at least on the radio on a regular basis. Like I say, it's always fun just being back in Dillingham. I'm always happy to come back to Bristol Bay. It's a special place, and and always will be for me.
Bob King, so good to have you in the studio.
Again. I appreciate it, Dave.
All right. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. One of the rules in radio news is to keep things short and pithy, which, of course, we just broke with that last interview. Beg your pardon. Well, we're going to try to make up for that here. As many of you know, the Western Alaska Interdisciplinary Science Conference is underway at the Bristol Bay campus in Dillingham this week with dozens of interesting short seminars on a wide range of topics. In an effort to cover that, KDLG's Molly Dishner and Hannah Colton have been challenging some of the presenters to sum up their research in one sentence or less, and at a level a fourth grader could understand, another radio news maxim. Here are the results, or what we're calling WASC 2016, in a nutshell.
My name's Todd Radenball. Yeah, this is the ninth annual Western Alaska Interdisciplinary Science Conference. We started this conference right here in Dillingham, and this is the third time that's come back. It basically goes to all hub communities across Western Alaska. It usually brings locals and scientists from abroad and scientists from Fairbanks and Anchorage, and it brings managers and policymakers all together so we can discuss issues related with fisheries, ecosystems, rural health care, solid waste, water quality, all the important issues that makes living in Alaska safe and happy and beautiful.
Hi, I'm Cherie Coker, and I'm a PhD student at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I think it's very important that we put a value on our subsistence foods, and I'm particularly looking at wild protein sources, fish and game. Number one cause of mortality in the world is muscle loss, and muscle loss can actually be changed by the types of protein that we eat. And so what I hope to do is to prove that wild protein sources are better at changing muscle loss and reverting it back to normal than any other type of protein in the world.
Hi, I'm Filip Amstislavski. I'm associate professor at the Department of Health Sciences at University of Alaska Anchorage. We work on biomaterials development for remote communities in the north, and I just presented on the biodegradable green insulation that can be produced locally in Alaska, not far from construction sites, and it was a really wonderful opportunity to have all this folks from, you know, builders, engineers, local community members to give their insight on how this can be developed here.
Hi, my name is Rebecca Esau, and I'm a master's student from the University of Saskatchewan. We want to know what the impacts of Wood Tick Chick Park are on the local communities. So we've got a model that we're hoping to come up and apply this summer.
My name's Milo Adkison. I'm a fisheries professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I've been studying salmon fisheries management and ways to make Tim Sands' job easier.
Most concise answer I've heard all day.
That was actually the title of my talk.
Hi, my name is Courtney Pegas. I am a PhD student at University of Alaska Fairbanks. And one of my chapters is focused on producing an ethnographic documentary that merges Western science with traditional ecological knowledge and local ecological knowledge, and using that documentary as a platform to promote science in Alaskan communities so that we could have diversity in science.
Okay, my name is Andrew Kukok, and I'm a 11th grader at Dillingham High School. So when I started, I wanted to figure out if you can possibly power maybe a home just on human power, like a small family powering all their stuff by just pedaling on a bike or just treadmill, all of that. So I just had a whole bunch of my classmates, and they biked on the treadmill on the bike for like 10 minutes, and I got their average wattage. And then after that, I basically averaged it out.
Is it possible?
No, not even close. Maybe a shack, not a home.
Hi, my name's Christine Wall. I'm a fish biologist with the Nature Conservancy. And my presentation was about potential changes in the Upper Nooshiak and Upper Quijack watersheds on salmon habitat as a result of climate change.
My name is Ted Jacobson. I'm the Solid Waste Tribal Liaison for the Environmental Protection Agency. I'm basically the help desk for all 229 tribes in Alaska with solid and hazardous waste. So I'm the garbage guru for the state of Alaska. When dealing with solid waste, it's obviously it's a contaminant, and there are human and environmental health hazards associated with mismanaging those types of systems. So what I'm promoting is managing the waste stream as appropriately as possible.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. Yo-ho, it's hot. The sun is not a place where we could live, but here on Earth there'd be no life without the light it gives. We need its light, we need its heat, we need its energy.
That was Waste in a Nutshell, produced by Hannah Colton and Molly Dishner. Well, in the overtime segment of this week's show, let's turn back to the Iditarod. Mushers are screaming down the Yukon River with the leaders of the pack leaving Ruby this morning en route to Galena. Allie Zirkel and Brent Sass playing a little leapfrog on the trail. Now, there's a lot of strategy coming into play now as mushers take their mandatory breaks, but when they get to Galena, they'll be less than 200 miles from the one community we know of in our listening area that's an Iditarod checkpoint, Unalakleet, which has long rebroadcast much of KDLG on their station KNSA, is expecting to see some action in town by the weekend. I dialed up our former colleague, Lorelei Ivanoff, who used to work at KNOM at Nome and now works for the CDQ in Unalakleet, to see what's happening ahead of their arrival. Lorelei, good to speak with you today.
Thanks so much, Dave.
So what's happening around Unalakleet? Paint a picture for me.
So the buzz is in town, the Iditarod buzz. We've had a few people, you know, out-of-towners, people we definitely know aren't here for Iditarod specifically. So we're seeing unfamiliar faces, and it started this buzz around town, and it happens every year. I remember it when I was a little kid, just kind of this feeling in the air that something is about to happen, that something exciting is coming our way, and that there's going to be a lot of action starting probably early Sunday morning, maybe Saturday late, but we'll find out.
They're moving quick, and now Allie Zirkel, as I speak with you this morning, Allie Zirkel is taking the lead over Princess, which is pretty exciting, so
yeah.
We'll see when they get in, no doubt in the middle of the night when everybody is probably asleep, but what's it like when the bulk of the pack is in town? Is it just a whole lot of fun?
It's a lot of fun, and actually, even when the lead musher comes in the middle of the night, if it's 3 a.m., people wake up and people greet that musher, and it's a loud event. I mean, people are screaming, clapping, excited. There's a lot of people that welcome the first musher, whether or not, you know, it's in the middle of the day or the middle of the night, and you can be sure that that musher is going to be fed really well inside the checkpoint. So it's an exciting time.
That's
We're
great.
All pretty excited.
Does it prove to be a little bit of an economic boost this time of the year for town, too? I'm sure some media and some other folks descend for this checkpoint that's you're only about 200 miles to the finish line, I think, so this is another big checkpoint on the way to those burled arches.
Yeah, it is a big checkpoint. All the mushers have taken their required layovers, so the 24-hour, the 8-hour layover, those are all complete by the time mushers get here. So the race really starts to heat up on the portage run from Caltag. And so there's a lot of media that comes here. And, yeah, there is an economic boost. People house, you know, the film crews, and money comes into the community. They have a fair, like a craft fair that happens every year. There's a pie social that happens at the church. And yeah, it's a good time, and it's it definitely helps out, and we all look forward to it.
Very nice. One more question for you is that I always hear about sea ice conditions when the pack gets near Unalakleet. How's the trail, and where does that sea ice come into play, and how's it look this year?
Well, the trail itself, like coming from Caltag on the portage run, there's no snow. So the mushers are going to see, and the dogs are going to see, just a lot of icy trail and some tundra. It's not ideal conditions, but it'll be, I think, pretty fast for the teams coming in. And heading out of here on the way, maybe 15 miles to Agavik, there's no snow again. So it's going to be a lot of tundra and a lot of ice. and some pretty hard conditions for the teams. And there's zero sea ice looking out of Unalakleet. I'm not sure how it is in Dillingham, but looking out from Unalakleet, there is no sea ice whatsoever. And mushers coming in and heading out, it's not going to affect their run very much just because they don't hit the sea ice until they head out of Shaktulik and head towards Koyuk. And from what I hear, it's pretty jumbled. The trail is pretty jumbled on the way to Koyuk from Shaktulik, but, you know, there's so much traffic between those communities that I imagine that trail will be smoothed out by the time the mushers hit it.
All right. Well, we'll hear those updates probably early next week. Let's leave it there. Lorelei Ivanoff in Unalakleet, thanks so much, and hope everybody has a great weekend there.
Thanks, Dave. I will, for sure.
Looks like it's shaping up to be an exciting finish. That's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. My thanks to Molly Dishner and Hannah Colton. Good luck to the basketball teams at regionals in Naknek this weekend. We'll bring you those results next week. And don't forget to change your clocks an hour as daylight savings time begins Sunday at 2 a.m. It's time to spring forward, everybody. I'm Dave Benninger. See you back here next week.